This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sex espionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in LA, binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
Hey, everyone. It's Estet Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
I like where we are. I like where I am in this fight because I think it's the right fight to have. And I think we must be in this fight. We cannot take a pass on this.
I'm Katie Kingsbury from the New York Times editorial board, and welcome to The Choice, a new podcast that brings you behind closed doors and into the exclusive deliberations process around the New York Times pick for the 2020 presidential candidate. In each episode, you'll hear Democratic presidential candidates make their pitch as they interview for the biggest job of their career. Every election year, the board chooses a candidate after closed-door, off-the-record interviews and a lot of internal debate. But the stakes are so high in 2020, and we think voters deserve to hear how we decided on our pick as the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. So we're giving you access to these conversations and the debates that followed so you can make the choice for yourself. To learn more about how the board works and who's on it, go back and listen to episode 1 of this series. We've trimmed each of these interviews down, but if you'd like to read the full transcript, you can find them on nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. It's been a decade since Senator Elizabeth Warren first visited the editorial board to pitch a new federal agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This time, she's pitching herself as president.
In our country, if you work hard and play by the rules, you ought to be able to take care of yourself and the people you love.
Corruption has broken our economy, and corruption is breaking our democracy.
The Massachusetts senator was first elected to office in 2012. Today, Senator Warren is vocal about her desire to recalibrate the scales of wealth and opportunity in America and has a plan to achieve this, starting with a wealth tax and eliminating student loan debt. Many of her policies implement larger, sweeping changes that will affect, well, everyone. So we wanted to know how she plans to speak to those Americans who aren't interested in major reform like Medicare for All. We apologize for the audio being rough at times. We recorded in a glass room overlooking the beautiful Port Authority bus terminal, using wireless mics that are great for television, but not ideal for podcasting.
So we don't have very much time together. We all know your resume and your bio, and many of us have met you in the past. So I hope you don't mind if we just jump right into questions. Should it be against the law for the children of sitting presidents and vice presidents to serve on the boards of foreign companies or otherwise profit from their parents' service?
You know, when I put together my anti-corruption plan, which is a big plan about the influence of money, I didn't put the provision in, but it was mostly because it's like so many things. I hadn't actually seen the implications of it. I think it's actually a very bad idea, and I would like to see it as part of an anti-corruption plan.
It's very a bad idea for the children to...
I just think it's got this... No one has to say there is a conflict of interest, and I'm not trying to talk about anyone's individual circumstances. But I think one of the things we have to deal with in public life is the appearance of conflict of interest. You know, that's supposed to be the guiding principle, for example, for judges. It's not whether or not there is a conflict of interest. It's whether or not people in the public could reasonably be concerned that it were. Because it's important that you believe that judges are acting independently and not influenced because they're going to get money or someone in their family is going to get money. And so I think that's where I think the analogy is the closest. And whether you make it a rule of ethics or whether you actually just make it part of the law, I think is a fair question. But I get why we should push in that direction.
So do you think that Vice President Biden has been forceful enough in his...
I'm not going to do this. I'm just not. I'm not here to take on Joe Biden and what Joe Biden has done. I'm glad to talk to you about why I'm running for president.
Okay.
But not to attack.
Senator, how do you first campaign in and then govern a country as polarized as the one that we're living in right now? Because this doesn't feel like a disagreement on a few policies. This is a situation where the cost of letting the other side win seems almost too much to bear for the other side. How do you realistically navigate that and get things done? Because it doesn't feel like the divide that you can heal away.
I think you're overlooking the places where we're not divided. I have three brothers back in Oklahoma. One is a Democrat. Do the math, the other two are not. And yet, all three of my brothers and tens of millions of people around this country get furious over the fact that Amazon reports $11 billion in profits last year and paid zero in taxes. All three of my brothers understand that we have an America that works great for giant drug companies, just not for people trying to fill a prescription. Works great for oil companies that want to drill everywhere, just not for people who are worried about climate change. So the way I see this is I think the old left-right division, yeah, there's a lot of that. But I think there's a very different division in America. And that is an America that's working for a thinner and thinner slice at the top and not working for much of anyone else. And there are a lot of Democrats, a lot of independents, and a lot of Republicans who see that. In fact, let me quote you a New York Times article from just last week that I thought was terrific. And that's about a 2-cent wealth tax and how it is popular across political lines. And it's popular, why? Because most of America gets that they're getting cheated in this game. And you get that wherever you are on that income scale until you get up to the very top.
Is that enough to bridge, you know, the ecosystems of misinformation and hyperpartisanship, things that are...
And even more practically, is it enough to get anything passed in a Mitch McConnell Senate?
So let me do both of these, because I think there are two pieces in this answer. One is, I think attacking the corruption in Washington brings a lot more people together than most folks recognize, and that it really does reach across party lines. The way I think we get something done in Washington, it's the Francis Perkins story. It's not enough to organize on the outside and have the marches in the street. Before the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, there had been dozens of marches, right? Lots of high profile. But the guys who ran the factories figured out it was a lot cheaper just to grease palms in Albany than it was to actually change their practices and put up adequate fire escapes and fire preventive measures. So just pushing from the outside, it's not enough to get it done. Just fighting it from the inside is not enough to get it done. But the 1-2 punch of pushing from the outside and leading it from the inside is where you see real difference. Look what Frances Perkins got accomplished. First in Albany, but then when she went down to Washington. So here's a woman. She goes to Albany at a time when women don't even have the vote, and gets herself appointed the head of a fire commission. And by the way, every time you see one of those lit up fire exit signs, right, exit signs, thank Frances Perkins, okay? But she not only does that, she then immediately expands it into labor law and workers and worker safety and worker protection overall. As you know, she then goes down to Washington, becomes the first woman cabinet official. And look at what she gets done in a short period of time. Social Security, minimum wage, right to join a union, end of child labor. The weekend, my personal favorite, that Saturdays and Sundays are not treated like Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. But think about it that way. So we start with the corruption. That's what Perkins started with. She started by outing the corruption.
But she needed the triangle shirtwaist fire. What is the contemporary equivalent of the shirtwaist fire?
Well, I'll start with 43 million Americans who are dealing with student loan debt. And not all of them are having trouble, but a whole bunch of them are. Or how about the parents of 12 million children who are struggling to find childcare? And I'm not just talking about one narrow slice. I'm talking about a whole bunch of parents across a wide range of zip codes and income categories who are struggling. I'm talking about the 36 million Americans last year who didn't have prescription filled because they simply couldn't afford it, or the 35 million Americans who didn't go have a lump checked out at the doctor. And these are people, many of them, with insurance, right? Couldn't afford the copay, couldn't afford the deductible. I think people are feeling this in their lives right now. And what is the spark, which is what I hear your question to be? It's you show them a path out. It doesn't have to be this way. You know, can I just say, the first time I think I came to the New York Times was during the financial crisis.
Yes, it was.
And I came here to talk with you all about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the very short version of this story is I went around Washington talking to people about how do not, in this crisis, simply outlaw the practices that were bad, that were used on the mortgages or used on the credit cards, because they'll be like fence posts on the prairie with nothing strung in between. And it'll take the banks and Wall Street about 3 minutes to figure out how to run around them by re-describing their product or slightly reinventing their product. I said, you've got to have an agency that when Wall Street moves, the agency can move. That's how financial products is the only way we're going to make this work. I went to Washington. I came here to New York to talk to people about the idea for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I heard two things over and over and over. Part one, that is a great idea. It would actually make a real difference. That would be structural change, or as I now say, big structural change in financial services. And part two, don't even try, because you'll be up against the big banks, you'll be up against Wall Street, you'll be up against all of the Republicans, you'll be up against half the Democrats. You'll never get it done. But we did get it done.
Well, you had your fire.
And the fire there was millions of people who lost their homes. But the fire by itself doesn't get it done. Fire by itself wasn't enough.
You have a lot of people in this country who actually, if you ask them that about Obamacare, that they hate it, you know, and these are the same people who are being wounded by the constant diminution of medical care under the Trump administration. How do you convince those people?
I said there were going to be two parts to this. So I've done part one about the inside-outside theory of change. But the second part, that's why we've got to do this through a grassroots movement. We cannot do this through television commercials. If winning the presidency, and I'll speak only to the Democratic side, is about who comes in and, oh, let's see, Dow drops $37 million in 1 week on TV ads. And that's what it takes to win a Democratic primary. Then we have a democracy that's just our TV ads versus their TV ads. And at that point, they're fake news. They claim ours is fake news, right? Everybody just gets further and further and further into their corners. The importance of a grassroots movement is there is one thing that beats fake news, and actually the data show this, and that's somebody you know. It's somebody who actually talks to you. It's somebody who does the face-to-face. It's somebody who reaches out. It's somebody who knocks on your door. It's your neighbor. It's the person who talks to you in line at the grocery store. That's part of it. When I did Inside Outside, it's also about the importance of building grassroots, building it from the ground up. It's why I made the decisions I made in running for president right from the beginning. But that it's, for me, that's at the heart of it. And then there's a second part. I'll push first to get the anti-corruption bill through. I'll push to deliver on a meaningful anti-corruption bill. And I think you can get a lot of people on board for that, Democrats and Republicans, to push for it. I dare you to vote against it, right? That is a fight I will have, and it will
be a fight.
Well,
it has to come to the Senate floor. I mean, Mitch McConnell already has an anti-corruption ethics reform bill.
I'm sorry, and who's fighting Mitch McConnell right now and from what platform? If you fight on ground where I think you've got lots of bipartisan support and you lead a damn fight, and then, just bear with me, if you can deliver and then deliver a 2-cent wealth tax, which has wide popularity, when I get to sign the piece of paper that cancels student loan debt for 43 million Americans, that's Democrats and Republicans. And I think at that moment, the world starts to shift. I think at that moment, a whole generation of people who have only seen the government as debt collector starts to shift. Will we get 100% of the folks on board? No. But will we get a lot more? Will we begin to talk about a democracy that doesn't just work increasingly for a thinner and thinner slice at the top? Or will we start to talk about a democracy that works for all of us? That 2-cent wealth tax is about childcare. It's about things that touch people's lives. It's about universal pre-K for 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds. It's about a $50 billion investment in historically black colleges and universities, tuition-free, technical school, 2-year college, 4-year college. You just deliver on something that matters to people. Now they got a stake in democracy. It feels like it pays off, that it's not just marching in the street over and over and over, and the next day you wake up and it's a little bit worse than it was today. This is our chance to turn that one around.
More from our interview after a quick break.
This podcast is supported by the new Porsche Panamera. When you follow the crowd, you lose something that few possess. Originality. By forging your own path and embracing the unknown, living fearlessly, without limits or reservations, and trusting your instincts, you'll chart a brave new course of your own. The new Porsche Panamera. Choose boldly.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice. Senator Warren has made Medicare for All a pillar of her campaign. She and Senator Bernie Sanders are both strong advocates for the single-payer option, and we explain the difference between that idea and the proposed alternative, a public option, in the episode where we deliberate about Bernie. But the specifics of the Medicare for All plan and what it means for private insurance has taken a lot of heat from opponents and isn't necessarily a message that has broad appeal. Senator Warren has backed off of it in her stump speeches as of late, but we wanted to hear how she'll convince the rest of the public it's the right idea.
With respect to what you will fight for, can you talk a little bit about Medicare for All and where it ranks in terms of your priorities? And then how do you convince people who are wary of massive healthcare overhaul yet again that that's the right thing, that that's the right approach to that problem, basically?
So I start with trying to understand the problem, what it means that tens of millions of people don't have prescriptions filled, don't go to the doctor. People with health insurance are being sued by their hospitals for medical bills. And I think of this as offering the most help to the greatest number of people as quickly as possible. So in terms of priorities, day one, there's a lot a president could do all by herself, and I'll do it. And one of them is use marching orders on prescription drugs. We can bring down the cost of EpiPens and insulin and other drugs so that we save families literally hundreds of millions of dollars. And it can be done without Mitch McConnell. You can, the power is already there. You've just got to be willing to pick it up and use it. Nobody else has talked about picking it up and using it. I'll defend the Affordable Care Act. from the sabotage of the Trump administration. That I can do all by myself. I will also fight to knock back the influence of money, because I think every time we do that, that's what that anti-corruption bill is about. It's about calling out the big drug companies. It's about calling out the big insurance companies and just disrupting the fabulous patterns they have right now to get their way in Washington. In the first 100 days, I'll go to Congress and try to get what we can get on 50 votes. And what we can get on 50 votes is to offer Medicare to everybody who's 50 or older.
So this is the incremental plan that you've talked about, right? So your first 100 days, you have essentially two health care plans, right? You have one that you would enact
or
in the first
three.
Day.
I mean, how do you want to count it? One is to reduce the cost for families on the first day.
Sure.
I mean, the cost savings doesn't come in on the first day, but you sign the papers that need to be done. So you reduce costs on the first day. The second is to give people the opportunity to be in Medicare if they want, anyone who's 50 or older, and expand the coverage for Medicare. It's to offer Medicare for all, complete health care coverage to everyone else who wants it. It'll be free for anybody who's under 18. It'll be free for a family of four making less than $50,000 a year. And it will have a small price for everyone else. This is the advantage to having already identified how you can pay for this.
So you have, on one hand, the most bold public option that's probably been offered by any of the Democratic candidates. On the other hand, you have the most aggressive Medicare for All universal plan that's been offered. And you'll be, if I understand it correctly, starting with this aggressive public option, hoping to segue to a Medicare for All by year three. And in the middle of all that, you will probably be called upon to defend the Affordable Care Act at the Supreme Court level. That just seems like an awful lot of health care reform.
Why is defending the Affordable Care Act in the Supreme Court hard? That's what lawyers are for.
Sure.
That's a legal issue. And they've got a whole bunch of lawyers.
But one of the premises for massive health care reform is that the Affordable Care Act is not working in a lot of ways, right? So you support Medicare for All, presumably because you think the Affordable Care Act has a lot of holes in it and we need to do something different. So you'll be defending that.
So I've identified pay-fors, and I lay out that if you want, you can get into it. And you've got a three-year period to be able to do it at a deeply subsidized price or at no price at all.
Simultaneously, though, all of the things that you've suggested you would need to do in order to afford Medicare for All, a wealth tax, cutting the defense budget, comprehensive immigration reform, would require the Senate.
50 votes?
Well, so you're going to
kill
50. The filibuster?
This is on budget reconciliation.
Let me try to frame it a different way. What do you say to critics who would argue that it will take so much political capital just to enact the first portion of this plan, the aggressive public option that you've laid out, that it will be essentially impossible to then segue to a Medicare for All? So, like, you'll spend so much capital getting that first part done that people have said, you know, it seems like a pipe dream to say we're going to have this aggressive public option and then we're going to have Medicare for All 3 years later.
So let me push back on what your theory of change is. Because the way the Affordable Care Act worked is we passed it, and then it was 4 years later when the benefits came in, and they kind of bumped into place, right? Look at it the other way around. What I propose is as many people can get into it as want to get into it, and then once they're in, try taking it away from them, because that's what the fight then shifts to. How did we end up hanging on to the Affordable Care Act when the Republicans had the House, the Senate, and the White House? And the answer was we ended up hanging on to it because enough people across this country said, you're not going to take this away from me.
At certain times, and certainly in the debates, it's come up that people who do not embrace your path lack the political courage or will, or they're scared, as you've said, to embrace big change. Now, certainly this will appeal to a lot of Democratic voters, but there are also a lot of more moderate swing voters, Democratic voters, who will be put off by the idea that just because they don't embrace your particular policies, they somehow are not courageous or that they're wrong in their ideas. So how do you reach out to these people? Because you can't win the nomination just with the progressive base. I mean, you've got to kind of convince these people who are nervous about the big ideas.
So actually, you know, I don't think of what I say that way. What I think of is the leadership possibilities that the candidates for president are offering. I don't know anybody who sits around and says, you know, I want to make peace with corruption. I don't know where those people are in America who think it's okay that Amazon makes $11 billion and pays nothing in taxes. I haven't seen those people. Now, Maybe they just stay away from me, but I don't think so.
But with particular policies, like, not everybody's going to be down with banning fracking altogether, especially in the state of Pennsylvania.
I understand.
Not everybody likes Medicare for All, where you do away with private health care. Not everybody's going to appreciate if you've suggested that the candidate that they happen to back now is in the wrong primary. I'm just saying these things will come back as you have to win voters in swing states, things like that.
So the way I see this is all I can do is get out and tell you what I'll fight for. And I'll point out the difference between the two. And I try not to get over my skis. I've really tried hard not to be personally critical of other candidates. I get a little heated once, but but once. And because I think this is the fundamental question. Do you think that this democracy, do you think that this economy, do you think this government is going to make it if all we're offering are little nibbles around the edges?
You know, my family is from Michigan, and UAW workers, one of the last things that they really love, many of them, is their health care. And so I guess, you know, my question is both a practical one and a political one, which is, you know, why not try and expand healthcare access without actually taking away programs that people already like? And is there a way to do that? Is there even a way to get to what you're talking about without talking about it in such dogmatic political terms? And how do you make, this is, I guess, the most important part of the question, I think, is how do you make the pitch to a UAW worker that what you can offer is actually better than what they already have?
So I've already made the pitch, and I actually had several unions say that it's a really good approach. I don't remember if UAW was one of them.
So let me
do the pitch.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you exactly what the pitch is. And that is, the Affordable Care Act already requires employers to provide health care for their workers if they have more than 50 workers. I propose we just keep that in place. And that will yield about $9 trillion over the next 10 years. That's what they pay. The plan is the employer has to keep paying in, as the employer does right now. The one exception to that is if you have a collective bargaining agreement and the employer is paying in more than whatever is the standard minimal that employers are paying in, that difference goes to the workers in cash. Now, that's only for collective bargaining agreements, but that's real money in the pockets of those union members. And secondly, what at least some of the unions like about this is the unions never have to bargain on this one again once you get all the way to Medicare for All, because their workers will have health care coverage, which means they can bargain once again over wages and working conditions and keeping jobs here in the United States instead of having to go back to their members year after year after year and say, we just bargained great for you. Your salary will go up 0.5%, and your deductible will only go up by another $2,000.
One of the board's biggest concerns for the future is the unbridled power of the technology industry and the lack of protection around data privacy. So we made sure to ask every candidate how they thought about antitrust in the Silicon Valley age.
What is the specific standard that you would apply in antitrust? Right now, we basically have a consumer pricing standard.
Right, and I don't think that's the right model.
What is the right standard?
I think it includes anti-competitiveness unfair trade practices. I think we need to resuscitate the old tying concept that we used. Market dominance by itself. When you totally dominate a market, that is anti-competitive. The platforms themselves create a new kind of problem that we haven't seen. We can only do this by analogy, which is what we always do in law. But think of it this way. You know, there's Amazon that owns the marketplace where people go and, you know, buy toasters and sell toasters. But they also are scraping bits of information off every one of those purchases. And when they decide that your toaster business is getting very profitable, and they might like to crowd in on that, they take all that information they took from you without your consent, and they go into the 2.0 version of your toaster business and move you back to page 7 on the search. And my view on that one is you can be the umpire in the baseball game or you can have a team in the baseball game, but you don't get to do both at the same time. So breaking the platform off from the competitive business, yeah, that would give a lot of small businesses a much more level playing field and able to compete.
I appreciate that the toaster is still your preferred consumer appliance.
There we go. That's great. Yeah. But the point is, there are some things about tech that are special. I mean, that we're seeing for the first time, kind of ways that you can be anti-competitive in a way that we hadn't seen before. Just like that was true in the early 1900s about you had the oil supply and you also owned all the gas stations, you know, and how that one worked, and we broke that apart.
But does that fix the power consolidation that's happening right now? I mean, if you took Facebook and spun out WhatsApp and Instagram, say, you still have a real dominance and a power that has been accumulated there, so Facebook, for example, in the media and advertising industry.
So you're asking the fundamental question about how you break them up. This was the question for Standard Oil. How did they break up Standard Oil? They ended up doing it actually by geography back in those days, but that's obviously a very different world from the world we live in right now. But look at the difference it makes if there are multiple Facebooks out there. If you can get to anybody's page, regardless of who they go through, it becomes like the phone company, right? You can have any different brand of phone, but I can, as long as I hit the same set of numbers, I will reach you. If you could do that through Facebook, then you've got competitors offering, hey, I tell you what, you come use my site and I won't be sharing your personal data with anybody. I will offer better security than those other Yahoos offer. I will offer you a 2-cent rebate for all of the advertising. I will offer you the option to click out of ads, or you'll only get one ad every minute. That's what competitive markets do. I like markets. I believe that capitalism can produce enormous value, but capitalism without rules is theft. And one of those rules should be progressive taxation. Everybody pays a fair share. And one of those rules should be you don't get to crush the opposition. That's not how markets work. And that's a battle we had at the end of the 1800s and into the early 1900s, and it's a battle we need to have again. The giants have grown, and they exercise so much economic power, but they also exercise too much political power.
Can I ask about that?
Sure.
You previously suggested that Facebook intends to use their influence in this election, Mark Zuckerberg especially, you're tweeting about that and mentioning him. And I'm just curious, do you think that Facebook could tip the scales in favor of a candidate? Like, what did you mean by that specific power? And is it something that, you know, an employee like Mark Zuckerberg is going to wield on his own or just the company's power in political
influence?
Look at
the example. He said, I will take your money to lie about other candidates. What does that mean for our democracy? Not even meet the minimal standard that TV ads run, right? I want to lie about you. That's why I ran the ad that said Mark Zuckerberg endorses Donald Trump. And they said, we'll take your money for that one, until they discovered what it actually said and said, wait a minute, not if you're going to talk about Mark Zuckerberg. Whoa!
And so that's just a process of fact-checking, and you want that to be independent? Because there's the issue of Facebook getting involved.
No, it's a process. It's an example.
Sure.
Of Facebook has way too much power.
Sure.
And they have too much power, not just in an economy, they have too much power in a democracy, and they keep consolidating and expanding.
Are you worried about individual employees there? Mark Zuckerberg, Peter Thiel?
I don't know individual employees there. What I know is the power of that place and how they're using it right now.
You've argued that nations that want to trade with the United States should be held to higher standards.
Yeah.
The Obama administration tried that. Trump administration tried that in different ways, but no results. What kind of leverage would you use? What would you do to get them to raise their
standards? I'm not sure I accept the premise of the question that they actually tried what I was talking about. Look, our number one leverage is everybody wants the American consumer. They want access to the American consumer. They want to come be able to sell us all of their stuff because the American consumer is not only the engine of about 70% of our economy. It's a worldwide engine. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, if you want to be able to trade with the United States on the best possible terms, then everybody needs to raise their standards just a little. Who wants to do that? And you may start out with modest increments and increase them over time. But there's no reason that we should be treating a country that is producing goods through prison labor or child labor or unsafe working standards or by polluting the earth, that we should treat a country that produces goods in that way the same way we're treating a country that produces goods with standards that are much closer to ours. We simply put our own businesses and our own workers at a competitive disadvantage. So we end up doing things like exporting pollution. You can't pollute here in the United States, but move this polluting industry, this way that you're going to paint dolls or produce chips, move it somewhere else where they have no environmental standards, and then resell and then sell those goods back in the United States.
Would you reduce existing market access in order to achieve that goal? So you'd put tariffs on existing foreign imports?
It's that you don't get the tariff benefit. I mean, this is what it's really about. It's where's the baseline, right? And is the baseline one that says across the board, you've got to give plenty of notice, you've got to work through, make sure you've got something that's achievable for countries we trade with. But this is not like trying to institute a trade war. This is not like saying we're mad at you and therefore we're going to impose all these tariffs on you and doing it as Donald Trump has done by tweet. But it's to work with nations and say, you want access to the American consumer, you've got to start raising your standards in a meaningful way. And here's where the long-term goals are, here's where you are, here's what constitutes moving toward those. And I think that's where a lot of folks would like to go. And frankly, we should be working with other nations on helping not just those who lag way behind, but those who have good standards, to be using the same kind of approach to trade. The idea that trade is just about tariffs is just old 20th century. Trade today in the 21st century is about regulation. It's about who's going to have to meet what regulatory standards. Whether we're talking about workers or we're talking about the environment, who has to meet what standards?
A huge part of being president is being the commander-in-chief of one of the largest military forces in the world. In past debates, Senator Warren has made comments about pulling American combat troops out of the Middle East altogether. A radical proposition given the current geopolitical conflicts we're embroiled in. We needed her to get into the details. A context note, this interview took place before President Trump ordered the killing of a senior Iranian general and escalated tensions with Iran, so that did not factor into our questioning.
Yeah, let me ask you about the Middle East. In the October debate, you said, I think we ought to get out of the Middle East. I don't think we should have troops in the Middle East. Did you mean nowhere in the Middle East? Do you think, for example, who should control the Persian Gulf, freedom of navigation? Should we close down the airbase in Qatar?
I think we need to get our combat troops out. I don't think that combat is advancing the interests of the United States in the Middle East, and it's time to end combat operations. Of course, we'll have a continuing presence in the Middle East. We have interests in the Middle East with our allies. We have interests in the Middle East in keeping shipping lanes open. And we will continue to have a presence there. But I don't think combat troops are how we best advance that presence.
So you mean getting rid of the combat troops there now or preclude sending any combat troops there in the future?
Well, I would take the combat troops out of there now. I see no immediate reason we'd send combat troops into the region. But I get the combat troops that are there now out.
We have combat troops in Syria now fighting ISIS, and you would bring them all home.
Yeah, I think we need to bring our combat troops home.
And leave the Kurds to their fate?
Look, we can work, and this is what we should have done. We should have been pushing for negotiations with Turkey, with our allies, in order to protect the Kurds. And we could do that as part, or could have done this as part of withdrawal. We could use economic pressure. We can use diplomatic pressure. We can use coalescing with our allies in order to bring pressure to protect the Kurds. And I think that's what we should have done. We've already abandoned the Kurds in the worst possible way and sent a huge signal to the rest of the world that the United States, at least under the Trump administration, is not a reliable ally.
Do you feel comfortable with there still being nuclear weapons in Turkey?
Look, I have argued for a long time that we need not to expand our nuclear arsenal, and that is the direction the Trump administration has been taking us.
But this isn't expanding the arsenal at all. This is existing weapons that may or may not be in southern Turkey.
Well, and I think right now the push should be not to expand, because that's the issue that's on the table.
Is it my imagination, or are we hearing almost nothing about voter disenfranchisement in this campaign? When, in fact, we saw disenfranchisement tipped races in Florida and Georgia, and you know, post-Obama, all kinds of disenfranchisement methods came online. But I don't really hear the candidates talking about that. Why is that?
Actually, I've done 175 stump speeches, and I've talked about it in every one of them. You all haven't covered it. I talk about three things that I think we need to do in this country. And the first one is attack corruption. And the second is to make some structural change in the economy. And the third is to protect our democracy. And it may be.
What do you say about disenfranchisement? Forgive me for not knowing.
No, it's fine. I do a constitutional amendment to protect the right of every American citizen to vote and to make sure that vote gets counted so you put real federal muscle behind it. I also talk about that for a specific reason, because a lot of Americans are shocked to know that that's not already in the Constitution and that there is no federal muscle behind that. I talk about rolling back every racist voter suppression law in America. We could do that at the federal level. I talk about outlawing political gerrymandering. We could do that at the federal level. I talk about Citizens United, although that one, again, is either going to take a constitutional amendment or some change in the personnel at the Supreme Court to reslice that issue. But I think it is important to keep that one on the table. And I talk about it because when I close, I talk about why those three things are related to each other. Why attacking corruption and getting some structural change in our economy that actually is about not just the wealth gap top to bottom, but this fact that more and more and more of our value is being sucked up to the top and more people are sliding back behind it. And not having power at the polls, how those three things are tied to each other. Because for me, they all are about a central question. And that's, who's going to get opportunity in this country going forward? Will opportunity be reserved just for those born into privilege? Or will opportunity be something that we say as a country, we're willing to make some hard choices to invest so that all of our kids get those opportunities? But it's hard. It's a lot easier not to take on the drug industry. It's a lot easier not to take on the insurance industry. It's a lot easier not to take on the oil industry. But every single issue we care about, every single issue, think about it on climate. All across this country, people are saying climate, climate, climate. If you're not willing to take on the corruption, we're going to get laws passed that are going to have great names. Save the world, everything is green, now save for unicorns. But it's not going to be real change, because so long as the lobbyists are writing it, so long as they're the ones who are in the ears of the folks in the House and the Senate, we're just going to keep making little tiny changes. And I just don't think we can keep doing that.
We asked every candidate what they were most likely to fail at, because we wanted a moment of self-reflection from them.
What are you likely to fail at as president?
And nobody does well at this question.
Yeah, I can imagine. Nobody ever wants to answer this, probably. To try this, you've got to have an optimism bias. And I do. I know that. It's an optimism bias that keeps me working 14 hours a day. It's an optimism bias that pulls you in more and more people to try to talk about this. But I take your question seriously. The place I might be most likely to fail is to get only part. Now, part's better than none, right? But only part. And that's a deeply worrisome thought. I know that as you sit here, it looks like, wow, this woman wants to do a lot. And it's hard. And the truth is, it is. I've spent my whole life studying working families, why they go broke, what's happening in America, why America's middle class is being hollowed out. Whole books written about this. And I watch every year two things, as it gets worse and worse and worse. Not fire worse, but a degree worse, 2 degrees worse. I watch that, and I watch as one more player in the game gets even more deeply embedded in Washington and Washington decision-making. One more player hires more lobbyists, spends more money on campaign contributions, puts more money into bought and paid for experts and think tanks so that nothing will change. It's like you talk about hardening between right and left. That's not the hardening. The part that's happening is it's hardening between the top and the bottom. When I was a girl, get a better than 50-50 chance of doing better than your parents. Today, that seems to be slipping under a 1 in 10 chance. Opportunity is shifting away from not just the poor kids. It's shifting away from everybody who's not born into the top. And sure, a few people roll the dice and make it big, and we should celebrate that. But it's like this fundamental question of who we're going to be as a country.
But how do you deal with the fact that while people might want big change, they're also afraid of it?
I don't know anybody who's afraid of a 2-cent wealth tax who isn't already a billionaire.
Why is that?
No, but I think this is important, okay? And I have seen the billionaire go on TV and cry about it.
But it's also about the Medicare for All plan.
But that is the specific, right? Is that this is the place where Democrats have fired on Democrats about how we're going to do health care. And I'll make two pitches on that. One is I think the best way we're going to do health care, this is just what I believe, is you do what you can to bring down costs. You get a little success on the table. It's a lot of success. It's hundreds of millions of dollars of success. You get that on the table. You start to offer people what's possible. You do what you can with 50 votes to offer people what's possible. And then when lots of people get experience with it and they say, I like this, this works for me, then we vote on it. And everybody gets better off and gets to try it. I think that's what's going to happen on Medicare for All. In fact, I think that is the way that we can solve our health care problems. But I get it. There are right now Democrats against Democrats on this. But understand this. We get into a general election. Oh, I know what the insurance industry will want to do. I know what Donald Trump will want to do. But the truth is, we're going to have the party who tried to take away health care from 35 million Americans, said it was okay to discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions, and is continuing to follow that right now, both in their lawsuits and in their agency practices, and millions of people have lost their health care. We're going to have that party who lost a bunch of seats on that in 2018 versus a party that we argue with each other about the best way to try to make sure that people get health care coverage, but at least we're trying to move in that direction. And this is a salient, personal, human fact. Your health care, your housing, getting your kids educated, getting your kids taken care of in child care. Every single one of those. I like where we are. I like where I am in this fight because I think it's the right fight to have. And I think we must be in this fight. We cannot take a pass on this. We got a choice to make as a nation, and the good news about 2020, the door has opened just a crack. That all the things that have been broken for so long, Donald Trump has made so much worse and gotten so many people off the sidelines. We actually have a chance, not just to nibble, but to make big change.
So that was the majority of the editorial board's interview with Senator Warren. To read the entire conversation, visit nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. To hear what the board had to say after Senator Warren left the room and a breakdown of her economic proposals, check out the deliberation episode. It's also out today. Join us back here tomorrow for an interview with Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar.
The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.